Welcome back to the Universalis podcast. I am Martin Kochański, the creator of Universalis, and in this episode I'll be looking at the highlights of the week ahead, starting with Sunday the 23rd of August. And I'll also continue with Dante and the Seven Deadly Sins, this week the Sin of Envy. Friday the 28th is St. Monica, and Saturday the 29th is St. Augustine. Augustine is the great firework of the early church. For a start, he wrote about everything. Whatever you wonder or think or argue about, he has probably been there before you. Does our salvation come from our own efforts, or do we all just sit around and wait for God's grace to hit us? How old is the world, and were the 6 days of creation literal days you could have timed with your watch? Whatever the question, you can bet that Augustine will have written about it, a sermon or a letter or a treatise, probably all three. And he isn't a figure from remote theological history. The arguments that he and his contemporaries were using are still ones we find ourselves reaching for today. I said Augustine was a firework, partly because of his spectacular rhetorical style, so characteristic of Africans. But Augustine is content as well as style, and he is a giant figure in world literature thanks to his uniquely intimate autobiography. It is called simply The Confessions. He published it in about 400 AD, it was a bestseller then, and it is still worth reading today. New translations appear regularly. Augustine's journey to God was complicated and full of detours, and in the Confessions he looks back on the journey and sees how at every corner God was behind the scenes, not pushing him, but quietly guiding him. Many of us have lives that are a lot less simple than we would like. We don't know where we want to go, and we are having trouble getting there anyway. Read Augustine. He did get there in the end. It is a reassurance and an encouragement to follow him on his journey. Great men have mothers. As Augustine pursued his career, learned from all the great philosophers of the ancient world, then, bizarrely, signed up with the Manichees, who believed in good and evil, a good god, a bad god, a good god who made spirit, and a bad god who made matter. Through all this, his mother prayed. She was there somewhere in the background. She never nagged, but she prayed. Augustine abandoned the Manichees and turned to Neoplatonism, a cold, barren, sterile philosophy. And Monica prayed. At last, Augustine met some actually intelligent and educated Christians. In particular, he met Ambrose, Bishop of Milan. That was a step forward, but still Monica prayed. Augustine was baptized in 386. A year later, Monica died. You might say that she had achieved what she prayed for. Read the second reading for Thursday in the Office of Readings page or in the Spiritual Reading page in Universalis. Its setting is a garden in the cool of the evening, that moment at dusk when you don't feel cold yet, but you know if you moved even a little, you would. So you hold still, and you stay outside just that little bit longer and talk in quiet voices. Monica has prayed her son into where he needs to be. Now she is able to depart in peace. So they talk. Monica died a few days later and was buried in Italy instead of being taken home to Africa. "Lay this body where you will," she said. In 1945, some boys digging a hole for a post for a ball game near the ancient port of Ostia hit something under the ground. It was Monica's tombstone, lost for 1,000 years. Hidden away in Wednesday's Other Saints section in the About Today page is Our Lady of Częstochowa. The icon of the Virgin Mary housed at the Jasna Góra Monastery at Częstochowa in Poland has been venerated for at least 600 years. It has been a centre of pilgrimage for centuries. It is more than that. It is the heart of Poland. In 1655, when the fat, safe and comfortable English had nothing better to grumble about than the Puritans abolishing Christmas, Swedish armies had overrun Poland, not to conquer, but to burn and destroy. 4,000 Swedish soldiers besieged the monastery at Jasnagura, which was held by 70 monks and 180 local volunteers. They held out for 40 days. The siege failed. The monastery with its icon was saved. Poland was saved. Poland was, of course, abolished later, at the height of the Enlightenment, as all those enlightened emperors enlightenedly carved her up and swallowed her, Prussia, Russia, Austria. Poland disappeared from the maps. The very name of Poland was not allowed to be published in the press. The Polish language was banned from schools. Poland was a thing from the past, a historical footnote. Poland gained her freedom in 1918 and was then enslaved all over again from 1939 to 1989. Through all this, Our Lady of Częstochowa still kept the title she was given in the Cathedral of Lwów in 1656, Queen of Poland. Here, because it says it all better, is the ballad to Our Lady of Częstochowa by Hilaire Belloc. Belloc had a long career, so I can't find out whether this poem was written before or after Poland became free in 1918. Perhaps it doesn't really matter. Lady and Queen and mystery manifold, and very regent of the untroubled sky, whom in a dream St. Hilda did behold, and heard a woodland music passing by. You shall receive me when the clouds are high with evening and the sheep attain the fold. This is the faith that I have held and hold, and this is that in which I mean to die. Steep are the seas, and savaging and cold, in broken waters terrible to try, and vast against the winter night the world, and harbourless for any sail to lie. But you shall lead me to the lights, and I shall hymn you in a harbour story told. This is the faith that I have held and hold, and this is that in which I mean to die. Help of the half-defeated, house of gold, shrine of the sword and tower of ivory, splendour apart, supreme and aureoled, the battler's vision and the world's reply, you shall restore me, O my last ally, to vengeance and the glories of the bold. This is the faith that I have held and hold, and this is that in which I mean to die. Prince of the degradations, bought and sold, these verses written in your crumbling sty proclaim the faith that I have held and hold, and publish that in which I mean to die. Let us return to Dante and the Divine Comedy and Purgatory. Here is the story so far. Dante and his companion, the shade of the Roman poet Virgil, have just climbed up from the first terrace to the second terrace of Purgatory. The first terrace was the terrace of pride, which is the root of many sins. So now, cleansed of the sin of pride, Dante finds the steep climb up to the second terrace almost as easy as walking on the flat. The less you are weighed down by sin, the lighter you become. The terrace of pride welcomed them with beautiful lifelike carvings showing examples of people who had no pride. They gave souls inspiration at the start of their purgation. But here on this second terrace there's nothing visible to welcome the poets, and actually nothing to look at all, just dull, mud-coloured, nothing-coloured rock. There is nothing to see, and that is exactly as it should be, because this is the terrace of envy, and envy begins with seeing. Envy is when I see that you have something I haven't got. When we were children, and you and I were sitting on the playroom floor, playing with our toys, and the cat was sitting watching us, all was peace and contentment. How happy our parents must have been just then. Then you saw the cat, and you wanted to stroke it, and you did. And I saw you, and I wanted to stroke the cat, which I'd been happily ignoring all morning. It's not enough to say that I wanted to stroke the cat, if that means that I now considered stroking the cat to be preferable to other activities. It was far, far more than that. In that moment, stroking the cat was the only conceivable activity in the entire universe. No other alternative existed. There was only one thing in the world that could be done, and you were doing it, so I couldn't. It was an outrage. It was as if the very cosmos itself was upside down. What happened next? I can't remember. But in a life-or-death emergency, any action is justifiable because it is necessary. And with an active attack of envy, we are not talking about mere life and death, but about something far bigger. Even for us as adults, the feeling of envy can be overwhelming. It obliterates the personality, and it comes suddenly, without warning, out of a clear blue sky. Or else it creeps up, like water slowly soaking up through the foundations of a house, saturating them and making the house rot and crumble. Now, feelings in themselves are never sins, because feeling is not something we do, it is something that happens to us. The feeling of envy is not itself a sin. What we do as a result of the feeling, that is the sin. Faced with the sense the devil has given us of a world completely out of balance, which is what the feeling of envy gives, we find ourselves doing, or planning, or intending, some great act of restorative justice to put it back into balance. You have something I haven't got? I can end the envy by stealing it. But even that is more human than the devil of envy wants, because it fades away into mere covetousness, and the devil wants more. Better than stealing the thing you have, I can spoil it so it's no use to anyone, not even to you. Or better still, I may be envying you for having something I don't want myself, but I know you are happy through having it, and I envy your happiness. So simply by depriving you of that unjust happiness, I can put everything right and bring the world back into balance. I hope I don't need to go further. You can see how things can spiral downwards from there. Or perhaps it isn't possessions. Perhaps the outrage is simply that you are happier than me in one way or another. Then I appease the devil of envy by restoring the balance. I may attack your happiness or undermine it, or I can be very pure and very pharisaical and quite distant. I can keep my hands clean and stand aside and merely feel happy when life brings you adversity, which it surely will. Summing it all up before it gets too depressing, envy, the feeling of envy, makes my world feel crooked because of you. And the sin of envy consists one way or another in the wanting or trying to make it not crooked any more. All this boils down to me seeing something about you. This already distinguishes envy from pride, because in pride one tries to be the only person in the universe. But now it is not just me any more, it is me and you, and that is what the trouble is coming from. A newly captured hawk is wild. As a wild animal, it is alert to any sight and to any movement, however slight, and any time anything happens nearby, it is quite likely to react by hurling itself violently about, breaking its feathers, or perhaps even breaking its silly neck. Some falconers put the bird in a hood for some days for it to get used to things. In the past, and even perhaps today in some places, they stitch the bird's eyelids shut with thread of very fine oiled silk. They swear that it doesn't hurt the bird, and they may be right, because the thing about birds of prey generally is that they are very, very delicate, and are quite likely to drop dead if anything at all does not suit them. The souls who are being healed of the sin of envy on the terrace of envy in purgatory have their eyelids stitched together with iron wire, so that they, whom the sight of seeing someone else being happy has been driving mad, can be calmed by seeing nothing. And then, if the wire is loosened a little, and then a little more, gradually, that calm will remain. Just as the hawk in the end is able to live with eyes wide open and fly freely and hunt, so the healed soul will in the end be able to see and be free. We, reading Dante, want to know, how do we get to there from here? Leaving aside all those images of nothing-coloured rock and iron wires, how can we cope with feelings of envy and not sin because of them? I say cope with feelings of envy, not abolish them. There are people who think that feelings are a bad and undignified thing and look at the trouble they cause, just as there are people who think that the body is a bad and undignified thing and look at the trouble it causes. But man is body and soul both, and the incarnation proves it. And man is emotions and reason both, and Jesus proves it. Stoic philosophy aimed at freedom from anything that might unbalance a perfectly balanced mind, especially feelings and emotions. Buddhism seems to view feeling anything at all as a sign of imperfection standing in the way of perfect nothingness. But Jesus wept when people were weeping over the death of Lazarus. Jesus was angry when the money changers were changing money in the temple. Jesus said to his disciples at the beginning of the Last Supper, "I have longed to share this Passover with you." So we mustn't deny emotion. Even if having our eyes stitched like the envious sinners might seem an answer, it isn't itself the answer, any more than plaster is the answer to a broken leg. It is not an answer, but only therapy, a step towards open eyes and a whole psyche which is free to feel and to fly. How can we take a step towards opening our eyes safely? One way is to see, at some level, how absurd envy is. Once at a time when I found myself envying everyone for any reason or for none at all, I drew the poison out of the situation by remembering that many of the people I was envying were probably at that moment also envying me. It was a ridiculous situation, and knowing it was ridiculous took the sting out of it. All the same, although this removes some of the danger of envy, it doesn't in itself cure anything. What does cure envy is love. Love lets you open your eyes wide, eyelids not closed with wire. Love allows you to see the happiness of others, and all that happiness does to you is make you happy too. Because when you love someone, how can you not be happy because they are? Love is the key. Dante is a great theologian of love. In Paradise, he is going to invent a whole new vocabulary for the operations of love. He will have phrases like, "If I could in you myself as you could in me yourself." He talks about in-othering. It's all his way of saying that in love, each of us is in the other. We are still individuals, still different, still unique. This isn't a question of two raindrops merging into one. But I am in you and you are in me. And looking at the present question of envy, how can I possibly be anything other than delighted if someone in me is happy, if I am in someone who is happy? That is the aim, so here's a straightforward exercise to try. When you are confronted, suddenly or slowly, with the fact that someone is in some sense happier than you, the fact, the brute fact, the brutal fact, the overwhelming fact, don't try to hide it away. Be overwhelmed by it, but be overwhelmed by delight that someone you love is happy. And if you don't find that easy at first, try loving harder. This won't abolish the feeling, but it does away with the sin, and eventually the devil of envy will get bored and go away. There does exist an opposite feeling of envy, the one which makes you happy at other people's sadness. The classic comic example is when the girl you didn't marry marries someone else, and you feel, despite your three-layered armour of shining, generous virtue, a slight feeling of comfort whenever everything isn't absolutely perfect for them. This is an embarrassing feeling to admit to us, no one does. It also needs to be sat on firmly. Love comes in again, another kind of love. For instance, suppose some rich friends are holding a magnificent party and inviting everyone from all around, and you go because you're invited, and you enjoy yourself because you're meant to. But all the same, when a whisper goes round that they're running out of wine, don't you feel just a little bit comforted? There are no carvings on the wall of this terrace because no one will see them, but a disembodied voice flies past and it says what Mary said at Cana. They have no wine. Because at Cana they really did run out of wine, and Mary didn't say to herself, that puts them in their place, doesn't it? She felt for them. That also is love, the kind of love we call compassion. If I am in you and you are in me and you hurt, then I hurt too. Love is the cure for envy again. And compassion is like a muscle in the soul. It is weak when we are children. It gets stronger as we grow up. And it's good to keep it strong with regular exercise. I know we're in purgatory, but at this point it's worth getting a glimpse of heaven. In Dante's heaven, everyone is unequal. Because I am not you and you are not me. And the question arises when one of us is, say, a weak nun who was bullied into breaking her vows, and the other is someone like St. Teresa of Avila, one is so much greater than the other, how can there not be envy of some kind? Dante asks this exact question in heaven, and he gets a long explanation in reply, but the souls he asks are really just longing to say to him, isn't it obvious? Because I am in you and you are in me, so your glory can only make me even happier than I was already. The full teaspoon does not envy the full ladle, because one is just as full of glory as the other. Sayers quotes a Muslim writer called Ibn Arabi, who wrote about the afterlife, because some people think that Dante got some of his imagery from him. Perhaps so. But on this very question of different degrees of greatness, Ibn Arabi misses the point entirely. He wants everyone in his heaven to be happy, and he is certain that if the less great knew that a higher greatness existed, heaven to them would be a place of grief and bitter disillusion. So, Ibn Arabi says, the less great are protected by not being allowed to know that there is a higher greatness at all. Which amounts to saying the only way to make souls happy is to keep their eyes shut forever. Or again, by making them live in a lie for all eternity. That is what happens when you try to imagine heaven without accepting the supremacy of love. The angel brushes another P from Dante's forehead, so now there are only five left, P for peccatum or sin. He is lighter than ever. The poets climb to the third terrace and find themselves in thick smoke. That's all for this week. If you'd like to write to us about anything, send an email to universalis@universalis.com. We look forward to hearing from you. Have a good week in every sense, and let's pray for one another.